Thank you. Let me just get thanks out of the road first and thank Fela for the opportunity to talk today. Joe for his welcome and his advice in setting up the event. And I think Kevin and Una as well just helping to set up earlier. In particular, can I thank all of you for coming on a particularly wet, horrible afternoon. And also just thank you for taking the risk to come to this event. As I stand here now, I am still not entirely sure how I got myself into this, but I am putting a large part of the blame on Father Martin McGill. I have been in some interesting places and interesting times with interesting people, but I am really an expert in no field whatsoever. Eamon Phoenix was my tutor back in Stranmillis about 20 years ago. And to say that Eamon taught me things is probably the only sentence that my name and Eamon Phoenix's could possibly fit into together. I have a very limited academic background in history, and I hope that everything I have this afternoon is historically accurate. But if you're looking for historical depth and intricate analysis, then this afternoon really isn't for you. I want to take a much more reflective look at 1916. My second disclaimer is that I'm a wee bit uncomfortable about being the person to deliver this. This idea of what the proclamation might have for prods. I am a prod, I'm a member of a Protestant church, but actually I really hate the word. And I'll confess that I only used it in the title because of the alliteration with the word proclamation. It kind of just sounded good and it looked interesting, so I'll stick with that. I'm not protesting about anything, least of all the Catholic Church. It's a historically redundant term. I probably fit much better with the whole idea of being a non-republican, because I'm not really a unionist either. I had a moderately unionist upbringing, and I have certainly held unionist opinions in my teens and maybe into my early 20s, but I feel that those things have probably worn off a long time ago now. And I'm not a nationalist either. Despite my membership of the SDLP, I've always wanted to sort of fit into that socially democratic group somewhere in the middle. In theory, nobody gets left behind. I will live with a government wherever, provided that government is fair and provided that we live peacefully. So while I'm from a unionist background, and I suppose we could argue that I am culturally Protestant, whatever that means, it's probably not really for me to speak from a unionist or a loyalist perspective. I love a good story. And over the course of my life, I've been interested in not just figuring out my own story and listening to other people's, but also to recognise the power that stories have. All of us are huge repositories of stories, and the power in that is not to be underestimated. And I've learned too that stories can often collide and contradict them, and we are quite capable of holding contradictory narratives at the same time. Contrary to popular opinion, working in an integrated school, they shouldn't be neutral spaces, as people sometimes accuse us of being. They should be diverse spaces. Everything shouldn't chime in the one way. There will be contrasts and contradictions in there. Just by way of introduction, as I slide into this, let me just give a couple of examples in my own life. The start of the summer, the four of us visited London for a few days and Winston Churchill's home in Chartwell. And the National Trust have done a really good job of almost sort of recreating his presence again in that building. You can see where he worked and dined and sat and thought great thoughts round the pond. And there's a real sense of his presence there. And I'm not mushy in that way, but it was a strange thing. And right at the end of the house, they've got a small exhibition to do with his death and the preparations for the funeral and the funeral itself. And wandering round that, it's not a really interesting exhibition. A lot of it's quite dry and black and white video. It's not eye-catching in any way. But in all of that, even though he died 10 years before I was born, there's something in that that speaks to my British identity, and I haven't really figured out how to put it into words, but there's something in it that says this story is also part of my story in some way. And London too, again, just seeing places that I've seen on television, seen in real life from time to time. Again, there's that sense of identification. There's a strong sense of British identity. And yet I've also had a number of holidays down south too. I've been, I suppose, something of a fan of an interest in Michael Collins, even before he was Liam Neeson. And I've been to Clonakilty and been round some of the buildings, that, you know, the schools and houses and places where he had lived or had interactions. And I've been to the roadside in Béal na Bláth where he was killed, and again felt that same sense of this happened 50 years before I died, but there's something here, there's something in this that is also part of my identity. Now, how you can have Michael Collins in there and Winston Churchill in there, I don't know. But they're both narratives that in some way are part of who I am. One other thing. Last year I got to be in Belfast during the 12th, the first time in probably about 10 years. And nobody else wanted to go and see the parade, so I was left to my own devices for the morning. So I walked into town, passed Béal na Fáil, accidentally picked up the lodge on its way into town, followed them in, went to the cenotaph and followed the whole parade with back out. I thoroughly enjoyed the morning. Because I like walking, I like flute bands, I like the noise of flute bands, I like the colour and the crack and the community of that whole occasion. And I suppose there's a nostalgia too of sitting on a small stool at the top of Rathgar Street with a flag in one hand and a can of Fanta in the other, and it kind of brings back, you know, 12th of July and gone past. While at the same time also quite disturbed by the whole thing, that it is a divisive thing. This is not a shared experience. And under all the crack and colour, there is an anger and there is an intolerance that doesn't sit well with me. And I have both of those things going on in my head at the same time. So I can hold these contrasting viewpoints. And I think that we are richer as people when we not only know a different viewpoint, but we can begin to appreciate it. Irish people, both north and south, are talkers, and we love story. And there are a few stories that are probably more dramatic than the twists and turns of Irish history in that decade between 1912 and 1923, though of course the story starts long before 1912. And 1916 is that key moment in the story of Irish republicanism. Now, there may be historians in this may disagree, I don't know, but for me, I've always seen the reading of the proclamation by Pearse on the steps of the GPO as the birth of the Republic. I know the reality doesn't come about for another 20 years or so after that, but that's the point where, as they say, things changed, all changed, or at least they begin to change at a much faster rate than they did before, though I suppose that's all open to debate. But the ideals at that moment, the ideals of republicanism take centre stage, and they are ideals that I think are alive and well today. Let me go back to one more holiday. Perhaps 10, maybe 12 years ago, my wider family and I were on holiday down south, and we were staying somewhere near Enniscorthy. And we visited the 1798 National Rebellion Centre. And somewhere as you enter, I think it was engraved on the door, circular engravement on the door as we went in, was a Wolfe Tone quote. And the Wolfe Tone quote was, "To unite the whole people of Ireland, to abolish the memory of all past dissensions, and to substitute the common name of Irishman in the place of Protestant, Catholic and Dissenter." And I remember that moment of, I think my dad was also there, and we sort of read it together, and I think his comment was something to the effect of, yeah, there's nothing you really could disagree with there. And it does, it sounds fresh, it sounds progressive. And he was quite right. I think the universal republican ideals of liberty, equality, fraternity, that sense of identification that people should have with people, those are things that we still care about in the 21st century. they are things that we will still be dealing with in the 22nd century. So in that light, we should be able to look at the proclamation and find something in it for everyone. However, I think before we get into that, there are two obstacles. Let me just loosen up. The first is a problem for unionism. Now, this is where I feel, a little bit awkward. But here's my take on it. I think unionist ideals are undergoing some re-examination. That's a whole separate talk on its in itself. And I suspect there are probably people here today who are better equipped to give that talk than me. But I want to touch on it briefly. Because I think if there's a sense of uncertainty in your own sense of identity, it's going to make it more difficult to look at somebody else's sense of identity and begin to appreciate it, especially if it's one that you've always been politically opposed to. So I want to be very clear about this. I firmly believe that there is a wealth in and a depth to unionist culture. It might be better to say loyalist culture. But at its heart, there is a desire to stay politically connected to three other nations in one union. And unionism has always been wary of the dominant country in that union, be it a Liberal government, Conservative government, or Labour governments. In turn, there has always been that wariness and a sense of distrust. And now, the second nation in that pecking order is re-examining the boundaries of that union and poking them and questioning them and, I suppose, threatening to break them altogether. And on top of all of that, aspects of what loyalism values are also connected in history back to ideals of empire and colonialism. Resistance to home rule had much to do with economics. The North needed the commerce of the empire. And coupled with that then was the argument that if Ireland received home rule, that it would be the thin end of the wedge and that the empire would ultimately be threatened. So while ideals of liberty, equality, fraternity have survived into the 21st century, empires are now frowned upon. There's a lovely moment on YouTube where Letterman is interviewing David Cameron. It happened about 2 years ago. It's not a serious interview. Letterman doing what Letterman does, just sort of throwing random questions at him just to see if he can get a rise or a stupid answer out of Cameron. And there's one lovely moment where Letterman sits back and says, "So, the British Empire, that was just awful, wasn't it?" And Cameron, is a little bit uncomfortable. Generally, he just bats it away. Now, that's not to say that there aren't lasting ideals from that period of history. The point I'm making is simply that I think they are harder to unpick. And because of this, the task of getting loyalists to appreciate aspects of the Easter Rising and the proclamation may not come easily. But there's then a problem for Republicans too, because the Wolfe Tone quote that I used earlier is only good for everyone if you take it out of context. Because if you read the preceding statements about why he wants to unite the people of Ireland, well, his reason is that it's in order to break the connection with England, the never-failing source of our political evils, which is not what you want to put on the door of your tourist attraction. So that bit gets left off the engraving. And here's the problem. It is hard to hear universal ideals when they are mired in a local dispute. If you feel an affinity for England culturally or politically, then it's hard to hear Tone's thoughts on the unity of all people in Ireland. It's going to be hard to hear anything in the proclamation itself, given that it was read at the start of a rebellion, which killed 450 people, that injured hundreds more, that destroyed over 200 buildings. All of this while Irishmen were fighting a war for a country that the IRB and the Citizens' Army were now rebelling against. Over the last century, two I'm not going to get into all of this, but many things have been done in the name of that republic that are now going to make it difficult for non-republicans to read and appreciate its proclamation. For any group to consider, in very general terms, an alternative narrative that they have previously felt threatened by, well, two things need to happen. It's going to take that group to have the courage to go exploring, but it also takes the other group to be patient and generous in its telling. That said, how do we, slotting myself into that broad group of unionists and non-republicans, how do we specifically find anything in the proclamation to identify with? Well, I want to approach this in two ways. The first is in the actual wording of the proclamation, and I'm going to look at that now, and then I want to show a video so you get a break from me, and then I want to look at a broader picture as to whether unionists should engage with the Easter Rising commemoration at all. At first glance, the proclamation has really very little that unionists could possibly identify with. There is the old tradition of nationhood, Irish nationhood, and a summons to a flag that, despite its origins, has never really been accepted by unionists. And then on top of that, we get secret revolutionary organisations in the tradition of previous rebellions, who see themselves allied to the country that many Irishmen are now fighting against. Then there is the rights of people, the Irish people, who have been usurped by a foreign government that unionists see an allegiance to. There's the rejection of that monarchy as part of that as well. And then, to add insult to injury, there's the claim of the Republic to everyone's allegiance, whether they like it or not. I'm going to suggest four ways, though, briefly, to look just at the text of the proclamation in a different light. For the purposes of expediency, I'm going to ditch using the phrase unionists and non-republicans and go with we, because it's so much faster. So firstly, it depends on how you want to see the old tradition of nationhood and the dead generations. A tradition of Irish nationhood still survives. We, speaking on behalf of my people, we still have an Irish identity. I think there is a much richer identity out there than Michael Collins' rather dismissive statement that the unhappy fate of the North East is to be neither English nor Irish. I know of few people who won't say that they're Irish at all, although I know of many people who will very quickly follow that up by also saying that they're British, or perhaps qualifying that to be Northern Irish. We certainly don't like to be mistaken for being English. Do our dead generations give us that tradition? Well, in part, yes. I think that's something we have in common. We have a tradition or a culture of honouring our dead, to the point sometimes I think that even we might err on a side of a culture of the dead, perhaps more than a culture of life, but that's maybe another talk. That phrase, our exaltation among the nations within the UK, but with an identity different to the rest of the UK, I think that's something that we can identify with. Secondly, coming to that part of the proclamation that talks about declaring the right of the people of Ireland to the ownership of Ireland and to the unfettered control of Irish destinies, the long usurpation of that right by a foreign people and government has not extinguished the right. Now, I think we're agreed on that too, again, perhaps in a slightly different way. As an island, we have overwhelmingly endorsed the Good Friday Agreement, despite the fact that it seems to be almost collapsing in popularity from that moment onwards. But the future government of the island now rests solely in the hands of the people living in Ireland. So that part of the proclamation, the long usurpation of that right by a foreign people and government, is over. To my mind, maybe discuss this later, it's long over. And it was long over when Peter Brook, as Secretary of State, made his famous statement that the British government has no selfish, strategic or economic interest in Northern Ireland. Now, I know that's a contentious one, and I will admit that in the current squabble over the budget, there are or arguably economic fetters that are still in place from Westminster. And I know too that many Republicans feel a concern over security issues, and there is an enduring distrust of the British government in all of that. However, the current political structures have been chosen by a majority of people. There's another way of looking at that phrase. I am first to say that I am not an expert on the writing of the proclamation by any stretch, but I am assuming that the people's right to the ownership of Ireland is not just political, but that that also references Connolly's socialist principles. I'm going to suggest that embedded in that short phrase is Connolly's belief that the capitalist system must end, and I'm going to quote from Connolly here, that Catholics, Protestants, Jews, Freethinkers, Buddhists, Mohammedans will cooperate together to get rid of what he referred to as the firebrand of capitalist warfare and offer instead the olive leaf of brotherhood and justice to and for all. Connolly had witnessed the poverty and overcrowding in Dublin, which, again, I'm no expert. I suspect was probably far worse both in scale than Belfast. One historian I was listening to recently noted that in the 1911 census, there were a series of 15 houses in Henrietta Street with over 800 people listed in the census as belonging to those addresses. So whether you're a socialist or not, I think it's not difficult to identify with Connolly's reaction to what he saw in his time and the aspiration that I would suggest is in the proclamation for a redistribution of wealth and greater possibilities, to quote, to pursue the happiness and the prosperity of the whole nation. Thirdly, let me look at that quote in its context again and look at it another way. The proclamation grants religious and civil liberty equal rights and equal opportunities to all its citizens and declares its resolve to pursue the happiness and the prosperity of the whole nation and of all its parts, cherishing all the children of the nation equally, probably the most famous part of the proclamation. Well, in terms of suffrage, it's very progressive language for its time, given that in the UK only 60% of male householders can vote. Women can't vote at all. Now, I know all that would change in 1918, although even then in Britain you had to be a 30-year-old woman before you could vote, or older. Also, in terms of religious and civil liberties, I'm finding echoes of the 1912 Ulster Covenant, signed in opposition to Home Rule, which unionists perceive to be, I'm quoting, subversive of our civil and religious liberties. So there's a care about both in there, and that is not the only echo either, which I suppose leads me to my fourth point, that in many ways the proclamation and the covenant mirror each other. They aim for different political ends. One is defensive. One strikes out for something very different. But they often explore the same themes. Let me take you through some of those. Where the proclamation summons us together to the flag and allegiance to the Republic, the Covenant calls us to stand by one another in continuing loyalty to the King. Both texts recall the past. The proclamation cites the dead generations, previous rebellions. The covenant refers to days of stress and trial. Both texts reference the links of their people to other people and places in the world, whether that's exiled children in America and gallant allies in Europe, or whether that's to the unity of the British Empire. Both texts naturally refer to the opposing forces. The proclamation, this is the long usurpation of the Irish people's right to the ownership of Ireland by a foreign nation, a nation that had carefully fostered differences in the Irish people. Whereas in the Covenant, the opposing force is the threatened calamity created by, I'm quoting, the present conspiracy set up a Home Rule Parliament in Ireland. In more general terms, I think the texts are both written in a spirit of good conscience. Being convinced in our consciences is the covenant's phrase. For the common good is how the proclamation ends. both documents are written from the perspectives that this is the right and fair thing to do, albeit from two very different perspectives. The actions that the documents call for are for the best for everyone, though I would argue that's probably more prevalent in the proclamation than it is in the covenant. I think there's a reaching out in the proclamation that isn't in the covenant. It's a much shorter document. The covenant really only references the rest of the island briefly and references the rest of the empire too. Out of that, both documents invoke the name of God for the protection of either the newly created Irish Republic or the right to defend the status quo. And perhaps because of this, both carry a sense of destiny to them. The proclamation directly references that august destiny at the very end, whereas the covenant talks about the sure confidence in God, whom our forefathers confidently trusted. So there are different allegiances, but the concerns for the future of a group of people and the passion and the emotion that those concerns arise, I think, are the same. And my point is very simply this, that if you have a strong identification with either the proclamation or the covenant, then I think you can see something of yourself in the other document. In saying that, when it comes to the place of the Easter Rising in the decade of centenaries, I'm not sure that the proclamation is necessarily the best place to start. Actually, I think the whole story of the Rising has much more value in it for unionism. I'd like to play this clip from YouTube. I think this is about a year old, maybe slightly less, I'm not sure. It's fairly self-explanatory.
Yeah, and should there be a bank holiday for the Easter Rising in 2016, seeing as there's one for the Queen's Jubilee? Surely this is only fair. Jerry Kelly?
Yes?
Has it been raised around the executive table at Stormont, to the best of your knowledge?
Well, it may well have been. I don't know where it would have got. It wasn't. I don't think it was raised while I was there. But yes, of course. We are talking about a shared society. We're talking about partnership. We're talking about all of that. There are Republicans and Nationalists who have a view of things that should be respected in the same way as issues which affect the Unionist and pro-British section of our community should be.
Okay.
Jim Allister?
Absolutely not. There's no comparison between the Diamond Jubilee of our sovereign in the United Kingdom and some foreign grubby failed rebellion 100 years ago in some other place. So there's nothing to celebrate about that other than its failure.
Well, not for you maybe, but maybe for Jerry Kelly.
But, you know, if they want to celebrate it, celebrate it, if that's the right word, in the Republic of Ireland where it happened, not in Northern Ireland. You know, in Northern Ireland, we do have something we should be celebrating this year with a public holiday, and that is the centenary of the Ulster Covenant, which was part of the building blocks of Northern Ireland. When it was the 50th anniversary, there was a public holiday in Northern Ireland to mark it. But under DUP Sinn Féin rule, there'll be no public holiday this year to mark the centenary, but no doubt there are moves afoot to try and get a public holiday to celebrate the 1916 Rising. I must say I utterly repudiate the comparison between that and the Jubilee or anything else which was essential to the creation of
Northern Ireland. Seriously be telling me you think everything that you agree with should be celebrated and everything you disagree with shouldn't be celebrated.
I think that that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying as part of the United Kingdom, we celebrate the Diamond Jubilee of our sovereign. If there's another country which thinks there's some important event in their history, such as the 1916 Rising, then they can celebrate it for as long and in whatever manner they choose.
Okay. Deirdre Heenan?
Well, I think Jim's answer and Jim's attitude highlights why we need to think very carefully about the very important commemorations that are coming up over the next number of years and how we're going to deal with them and how we deal with them in a way that respects diversity and different communities within Northern Ireland. And to refer to something as grubby and all that kind of derogatory language does not move us forward one iota.
Well, I think that we do have to make a distinction between things which pertain to the United Kingdom and events which may be important to Republicans in Northern Ireland, but which actually pertain to another country. And if we're going to have days in which we set aside for celebration, then they should be pertinent to our own country. I mean, the Americans celebrate the 4th of July, but we don't. And a lot of Americans here, a lot of American connections, we don't expect it to be a public holiday here. The same as Bastille Day in France. That's an important day for the French. And the Queen's Jubilee is an important, our anniversary is an important event in UK history.
Yeah, but the Irish are not as foreign as the French or the Americans, are they, in Northern Ireland?
But nevertheless, the 1916 rising is something which is pertinent to the history of another sovereign country which happens to share the same island as we do, if they wish to celebrate it in a certain way. And indeed, if people in Northern Ireland who feels an affiliation there wish to have it celebrated, I am sure they can think of appropriate ways in which that can be done. I personally would not take the view that they should not have the right to celebrate it, but I don't think it should be given the same status as something which is of national importance to the UK and the UK alone.
Okay, but how significant is it that Martin McGuinness has said the executive will consider a proposal from Peter Robinson to make a gift to mark the Queen's Diamond Jubilee? He doesn't seem to be averse to that suggestion.
No, he doesn't. I mean, I think that when people, we've heard earlier on, people talking about, is there no vision in Northern Ireland? I mean, Peter Robinson equally, of course, has sought ways of reaching out to the nationalist and the Republican community to try and show that we want to work our way forward, and has taken some symbolic steps to do that.
Okay.
And I hope that Martin McGuinness will reciprocate the actions that Peter Robinson has undertaken as well.
David
McGuinness. Now, obviously, to wade into this, I'm interested in Jim, because you already celebrate something that happened in a foreign country called the Battle of the Boyne. Just said to me it was the same country then, and in 1916,
the Battle of the Boyne.
Hold on a second. In 1916 it was the same country then too.
Yeah. The Battle
of... what do you want?
The Battle of the Boyne.
If you want to get into the politics of insults and slurs, anyone can do it.
No,
it doesn't bring you forward at all.
The point about the Battle of the Boyne is, it was of European significance. It was of particular... Yes, it was. Anyone who knows their history will know it was of European significance. It was particularly of significance to the formation and the constitutional formation of this United Kingdom, because at the same time filled the Bill of Rights and everything else upon which the Constitution of the United Kingdom is built.
Okay,
so
but
it is.
But you take Dylan McWilliams' broad point, don't you? That it's a little bit more complicated than maybe you suggested in your first answer.
Well, I'm simply saying that there's nothing for me to celebrate in a 1916 rising in another place.
No,
other than to celebrate
not,
that it failed.
Yeah, but with respect, it's not about you celebrating it. It's about allowing other people who want to celebrate it to celebrate it on the same basis that you want to celebrate what you
want to celebrate.
That's the point.
If you're saying to me that a rebellion by Irish rebels akin to the murderous activities of the IRA should be celebrated in Northern Ireland, then I'm sorry, I don't agree.
I think Jim tells us all we need to know when he says there's nothing for him to celebrate. This is not about you, this is about the future.
I don't want to be...
Well, lively debate, sounds good. I'll get there in a moment. Let me come at this in a slightly different way. Over the last few weeks, I've been reading a book called Knowledge in the Blood. It's a book by a South African academic called Jonathan Jansen. He was the first black dean in any faculty, although his was Faculty of Education, in the University of Pretoria, which was not just previously a white university. This was, an Afrikaans university with Afrikaans values, perspectives, traditions, history, absolutely steeped in that. And he has written this book, Knowledge in the Blood, stealing the phrase from a a book by the Irish poet MacDara Woods. I haven't been able to get my hands on that, so I'm going to come at it. If you're familiar with the poem, I hope I don't ruin it for you, but I'm going to come at it from the perspective of Jonathan Janssen rather than the perspective of MacDara Woods. The idea that we carry emotional, spiritual, social, and even maybe at times economic or political knowledge that is imparted to us and is embedded in our community. The quote from Woods that Janssen uses is that this knowledge is as ingrained as a disease, but can also be benign. It is not necessarily a bad thing. And Woods says that it has been gathering since childhood and is continually handed down. Now, Janssen is particularly interested in this because training South African young people, particularly white South African young people, to be teachers in a new South Africa, he talks about trying to work with all the knowledge that they bring with them that has been passed on to them. None of them are of an age where they have a working knowledge of what South Africa was like pre-1994 when apartheid came to an end. But they bring with them the stories and the concerns and all of those aspects, emotional, spiritual, social, economic, political ideas that come from their parents, who in turn have taken on the things from their parents and their grandparents, dating particularly to the Boer War. And there are some very strong experiences coming through that that have been passed on generation to generation. And so his idea is, what do you do with that? How do you help young people work through the knowledge in the blood that has been passed on to them? So you could guess that it's not a book that I've been able to read, you know, dispassionately without continually seeing similarities between Irish history and our current political climate. I'm going to drift back to 1916 in a moment or two, but I want to dwell on that idea just for a moment or two longer. Janssen's idea is that this knowledge in the blood is faithfully transmitted. It is with the best of intentions. It is habitual. It is how we see the world and ourselves and others. It is often emphatic. It doesn't tolerate ambiguity terribly well. It can be, isn't always, but can be defensive. It reacts badly in contact with rival knowledge. And I'm quoting Janssen here. He says that it is often fixed. It's inflexible, certain, controllable, linear, predictable. And finally, and I quite like this bit, he says it's not just knowledge that is committed to the mind. It is also encased in the heart, which makes it very difficult to hear a different story or a fresh perspective, because the stories that we carry might then be disrupted, might lead to a non-linear understanding of something we knew before, and then into the murky water of less certainty. If we're honest with ourselves, I think it is something that we can all identify with. It's not just something that was being played out in that video clip. Janssen acknowledges that that knowledge in the blood is a difficult thing to change. But if it's going to change, there has to be a transfusion. It needs to be a steady, slow drip over a long period of time. Perhaps we need to question why it needs to change at all. Does everybody not have the right to decide on what knowledge they carry with them? Well, the answer to that is yes, they do. But Janssen also talks about South Africa, again, I've got a quote from him, as being an anxious society, living with unresolved fears and collective fantasies, repressed anger, guilt, and shame. I think the same can be applied to Northern Ireland, albeit in many different ways. Baroness O'Loan was speaking at Carrie Mill at the weekend, and I read her address briefly, but one part stood out for me, where she commented that we still don't understand that we're not a threat to each other. And that's the product of one fixed perspective, at least that's part of it. When we are rigid in one outlook, then we become too easily fearful of people around us. I don't know anybody that desires to live fearfully. And so I think the challenge is there for each of us to address our own knowledge in the blood in simple steps, to recognise the stories that we hold, to consider where we have picked those stories up from, to consider the values that are held in them, and then to begin to ask, well, what are the alternative stories out there? Now, that process may mean that our own culture and our own identity doesn't change, that our own core values aren't shaken. But in the process of exploring different perspectives, we may come across something, a shared sense of common values with other people that we were previously wary of. We may in time, in that process, to change Johnson's comment, find a lessening of our anxieties, or less thought about our worst fears, or a cooling of our anger. And this, to get back to it, is where I think the centenary of the Easter Rising, or any other event in that decade, is most important. There is no unionist history. There is no nationalist history. There are unionist and nationalist perspectives, and there isn't one of each. And there are perspectives that are neither. But it's the same past that everybody lives through. The Covenant, the gun running, and the Ulster Volunteers all play their part in the events of 1916. The First World War plays its part in 1916, and 1916 plays its part in the First World War. Jim Allister's understanding of history, to my mind, seems to be much narrower, much weaker, considerably more inaccurate when he dismisses Easter 1916's importance. Although, when somebody describes it as foreign when it happens within the UK with its one parliament, you do have to question his understanding of history completely. It wasn't foreign. And it was linked to events in the north. The Rising included people with connections to the north, such as Winifred Kearney, that Joe, flashing at me, that Joe has already referred to not far from here. Bulmer Hobson. Tom Clark grows up in Dungannon. Sean McDermott joins the IRB in Belfast and then proceeds to help organise Sinn Féin throughout the north. After the Rising, the Army's prosecutor in the court martials, or should that be courts martial? I'm never sure about that. Was William Wiley, who came from Coleraine. He was born in Dublin, but grew up in Coleraine, went to Coleraine Inst. Even just within the signatories of the proclamation, there is broad experience of both the UK and America. So while the Rising is in Dublin, the origins and the experiences of many of the key players are not restricted to the city or even just to a handful of southern counties. I'm not sure what Jim Allister meant by the word grubby. I suppose I could agree if he was talking about the nature of rebellions and revolutions. They are painful, they are destructive, they are disruptive. Yeah, I could maybe go with that. But if he's referring to the moral character of the participants, then I really can't agree. Don't get me wrong, I am not going to be an apologist for an armed uprising. But when you take the background of the signatories, men who had overcome adversities, some of whom were family men, some were devoutly religious, they weren't skulking thieves. They didn't lurk around in the shadows waiting for a moment for rebellion. They held down respectable jobs: barman, soldier, teacher, treasurer, lecturer, tobacconist. I've never met a tobacconist, but we'll give them the benefit of the doubt. They were united and genuinely believed that there was a better way for Ireland and that the basis of that better life would be a republic. Which takes me back to the signatories of the Covenant. Now, it's hard to look at the similarities between the leadership of the Ulster Volunteers and Easter 1916. There is considerably more wealth and privilege within the leadership of the Volunteers. But looking at the signatories, I can look back at a great-grandfather of my own who signed up, served at the Somme, and was a local tradesman. I mean, the rest of his life is perfectly normal after that point. He was a plumber, an air raid warden in the next war. He was a mason, a bowler, Presbyterian elder, which is the epitome of respectability, I can assure you. There was nothing about the rest of his adult life that ever suggested he joined a rebel army at the start of it. And he too genuinely believed that the way of life, as it was for him, was under threat. And he signed up to a cause with integrity. David Simpson, referring to the march that is planned next year around Easter in Belfast city centre, is also on record as saying that 1916 has no relevance to the people of Northern Ireland. Excuse me, 2 seconds. But the reality of that is that even if we set aside the key players' connections to the North and the parallels between volunteers on both sides, we would still be worse off without the full story. If unionism just takes the Covenant and the volunteers and the war, specifically the Somme, and then the setting up of the Northern Ireland government, what sense does that make when so much of the story has been lost? And it's everyone's story. So in the decade of centenaries, we need to get beyond celebrating events in isolation. We need to look at a context, root causes and knock-on effects. I will give Jim Allister one thing. I think he makes one fair point. I'll give him this. When he refers to the 12th, we know it's an event. But for all of its celebration, how many people in Ireland have more than a superficial understanding of its causes and effects? To return to Jansen for a moment, when he talks about this knowledge in the blood, he makes the point that historical events in that knowledge tend to be thematic and not overly specific. But if the Battle of the Boyne is critically important, and I've no reason to disagree, then why isn't that being communicated more clearly? It's a pattern I think we all fall into within even living memory. I think too easily we speak about events over the last 30 or 40 years in isolation without understanding a greater degree of complexity. If I take one example, the shooting of the two corporals outside Casement Park in 1988, that event makes no sense unless you also tie it to Milltown Cemetery and to Gibraltar and to Enniskillen and to 100 other events that happened around and about at that time. Isolated events don't make any sense in themselves. When we lessen their context, it not only weakens the story, it changes the story, and I think too it probably lessens the humanity of the people who are involved in that. I am winding my way towards closing. However, I am a Presbyterian. And when Presbyterian ministers say "and finally," it usually means nothing at all. I want to wind up with one more aspect. There are themes in 1916 that I think non-Republicans can engage with. But 1916 is also part of a wider story. And it's a story that hasn't finished yet. And I've tried to argue the case that it is essential that non-Republicans engage. But I want to close with this question, and that is, what can we engage in? Let me take you back to one other piece of holiday reading. There's a book called For the Bible Tells Me So by an American academic called Peter Enns. I don't want to get bogged down in biblical history, but he makes an interesting point. Within the Hebrew Scriptures, the Christian Old Testament, there are two stories of Israelite monarchy. One is told in Samuel and Kings, and the other is told in the books of Chronicles. They have a massive degree of overlap, but they also have substantial differences. And the reason for that is that they are written at different times. Samuel and Kings is written in the 6th to the 5th century BCE, at a time when the people have been taken into exile. They're no longer in Israel. Chronicles is written a century later, in the 4th century BCE, after the exile. The exile hasn't finished. Some of the exiles have returned home, many stay put, but some return home. And those two books that have overlaps are written at different times. for this reason. Both sets of writings create a past in order to address the present. Samuel and Kings, they're written during the exile, and they address questions like, where did this go wrong? What did we do to deserve this? Chronicles, however, is after that has happened, and it addresses very different questions. What's going to happen now? Were the promises that were made to us centuries before, do those things still hold in the light of everything that happened? What is our future? Do we have a future? I'm hoping you're with me and perhaps a little bit ahead of me. The ancient world doesn't look at history the way we do. Historical accuracy is not high on their priority. They look at stories of the nation to inform the present. Maybe in a not dissimilar way to Yeats and Pierce dipping back into Celtic myth and stories of Cathulain. Now, I'm not suggesting for 1 minute that we rewrite history. But I am suggesting that the past serves the present. And that's the key idea from Ames on this. The past serves the present. That we are not boxed in by our past. It should lead us to an understanding of it and a respect for it. But should then lead us to a culture of life in the present rather than a culture of death. So like the ancient writers of the Hebrew Scriptures, we need to ask, what is the past's gift? What is the past giving to the present? Let's earth that a bit. There's going to be a parade in the city centre. It's already contentious and we're not even in 2016 yet. I don't know what that's going to look like. But I ask, will I be able to come to it? I've read about the parades in 1966, and I think I'd be comfortable with that kind of thing. Not if it's going to involve covered faces and dark glasses and shots fired into the air at some point. I really haven't thought this through. Maybe that parade needs to be a Republican version of the 12th. I don't know. I'm open to persuasion. And I might attend that. I may not be entirely comfortable. But I am at that stage where I want to engage in alternative narratives. So I think I could go and I could do that. However, I know lots and lots of non-Republicans who won't. And I know this because trying to drag some of them to the St. Patrick's Day parade in all its innocence has been near on impossible. So the Easter Rising parade, that one's going to be a tough gig. But if they won't attend that, then what else can they attend if those events aren't overshadowed by what happens at the parade? What are the ways to attract the attention of the many unionists or non-republicans who wouldn't normally give the Easter Rising a second thought? I really like the Irish government's approach to the Rising. I haven't time to go into it now. It's all on the website. But I want to use one quote. The website says that their commemoration will be informed by the complexity of historical events and their legacy, of the multiple readings of history, multiple identities and traditions which are part of the Irish historical experience, which sounds good to me. And there's one other idea now that I really like. The 15th of March is being set aside as Proclamation Day. There's a pack being sent out to all schools to encourage pupils to write their own proclamation. What would that look like in the 21st century? And so I need to ask, well, why would we stop at school pupils? Why shouldn't everybody do it? North and south of the border, unionist, nationalist, neither. Whether you were born in Ireland or whether you have come to Ireland, because that's a significant part of our population now. And I think there's also a need to share what we've written as well. Let me close up. I first heard the story of the Easter Rising in Mr. Rolston's A-level class well over 20 years ago now. And even from my moderately unionist background, I could appreciate it as a thrilling, heroic tale. It makes the pulse quicken and the blood rise. And I'm not even a Republican. It is potent stuff, although I noticed that in some of the retellings and documentaries and dramatisations, much more time is spent on the deaths of the seven signatories than on the 256 civilians who lost their lives. So I ask, where does 2016 take us to? is the message going to be that 1916 is unfinished business, in the sense that we came close, but another push is needed, that bloodshed remains a cleansing and sanctifying thing, that Irish identity can only be preserved by sacrifice? I was in the car at the weekend when Paul Brady's song The Island came back on. Up here we sacrifice our children to the worn-out dreams of yesterday and teach them that dying will lead them into glory. Or can we hold to the proclamation in a different way? Just as we can't read history through a 21st century lens, neither can we bring forward the actions of Pearse and Clark and Connolly and then apply their 20th century context today. The proclamation is a historic event. It is an important historical document, but it is only one expression of ideals that, as I said earlier, are alive and well today. And I think that there is a spirit in the proclamation. It's not just about the arrangements for government. It is about the life of people, of all the Irish people. A perfect state of religious and civil liberty, equal rights, equal opportunities, happiness and prosperity, well, it hasn't been reached, and those ideals will never be perfected. But we've come a long way since 1916. We are not who we were. And I think there's a strong argument to be made that Pearse's Irish Ireland has been achieved. Looking back at the years since, I think that the spirit of the proclamation would suggest that enough Irish blood has been shed and that Ireland is the life of its people. It doesn't require the death of anyone else. And I think that that same spirit is generous enough for others to share in it, and that the proclamation has space not only for Republicans, but for the prods as well. Thank you for your time this afternoon.